This is case 22 from the Shoyoroku, Book of Equanimity. Yantaos bow and shout. Introduction. People are probed with words. Water is probed with a stick. Pulling out the weeds, looking for the way, is what ordinarily applied. Suppose suddenly there leaps a burnt-tailed tiger, then what? Case. When Yantao came to Deshan, he straddled the threshold and asked, "Is this ordinary or is it holy?" Deshan immediately shouted, "Ha!" Yantao bowed. Dongshan heard of this and said, "Anyone but Yantao would hardly get it." Yantao said, "All Dongshan does not know good and bad. At that time, I was holding on with one hand and putting down with one hand." Hongzhi's verse. Demolishing the oncomer, holding the handle of authority. Tasks have a matter in which they must be carried out. The nation has an inviolable law. When the guest serves reverently, the host becomes haughty. When the ruler dislikes admonition, the ministers flatter. The underlying meaning, Yantao asked Deshan, one upholding, one putting down, see the action of mine. So I want to say that I'm very encouraged by your practice, by our practice together. Mostly by the sincerity of your practice. We don't measure it by how well you sit, how often you move, how quietly you are with jihatsu. Yeah, all these things do matter. But what truly matters is how open you are coming up here. How willing are you to actually look, take a sincere, close look at what's holding you back? Because really, that's the heart of it, isn't it? Everything else is just important, but leads to opening up the heart, or should lead us to that. So I want to thank you for being so open and willing to go to where it hurts, right? So what are we doing here at Sesshin? Why is it that we take a few days of our precious time and devote them to seclusion and silence? And during multiple periods of zazen, long days, aching bodies, why are we doing it? I'm sure you ask yourself, especially when the knees are screaming at you, right? Why the hell am I here? But there are two answers to this question, or we can look at two answers for this question. Each of them stands alone as a fitting response, yet they are intimately intertwined and inseparable in relation to our lives. The first way to answer this is to this why is simply not for any other reason. Not for any other reason, right? Just that. This is an extremely powerful way to handle a mind that does not stop asking why, like a child, and is always looking for explanation and justifications. And when this why is met with not for any other reason, the attention naturally returns home to the experience of the moment without looking for an alternative or an escape. It also has the power to quell our proclivity for judgmental thinking. It is the most direct way to cut through entanglements and actually experience the immense beauty of life. So why did you come to Sishin? Not for any other reason. How amazing is that, right? Because the mind doesn't know what to do with it. What do you mean, not for any other reason? What is the reason? Again, not for any other reason. And it works, so use it. The second answer is, because we are aware of the sickness that infects all of us as human beings. It is a reason. It's an important one that we should be aware of. Right? So we are aware of that, and deep down at the core of our existence, we recognize the practice as the medicine for that disease. And this disease has many symptoms. One of the most common symptoms of this disease is our impulsive habit to chop up reality into fragments and then use them to create conceptual pairs of opposites, which then become catalysts for anxiety, restlessness, discontentment, and on and on. There's here and there. There's now and later. My likes versus my dislikes. Being up on this mountain at Sishin versus being at work or in the city. Being engaged with spiritual practice versus dealing with mundane activities. Good and bad, you and I, life and death. Endless production of conceptual opposites that we experience in our life as real and tangible. In fact, it keeps the mind very occupied, even here at Sishin. And the problem with seeing reality through conceptual pairs of opposites is that it creates the illusion of a separating divide, the illusion of a threshold of sorts that often becomes a dwelling place for us, inducing a sense of paralysis and indecisiveness. Even when we do make a decision and take a step, there's always in the background, should I have taken the other side? Was that the right decision? My entire world of picking and choosing is born from the threshold, from having a threshold. An old master once said, someone with clear eyes has no nest. And to have no nest is to have no threshold. To have no nest is to have no divide, no sides, no dualities. So what does it mean to have clear eyes? As practitioners, we often use the term Zen practice in reference to Zazen and all the other aspects of the tradition, but what we call Zen practice is actually Zen training. Right? It's not just keep doing it over and over again, right? Because we can do it over and over again and maintain the same dualities, the same thresholds. Nothing really changes. But if we see it as training, then that already is a different way to sit, a different way to chant, a different way to do whatever it is we do as practitioners. It is a process of training that's designed to push us out of the dogmatic and restricted way of being so we can function in a way that it is radically, radically different than the conventional and the logical. And after we observe the mind for a while, we do realize that much of the time it is preoccupied with creating divisions and building walls between them. And it does so in a way that creates an organized roadmap that actually seems to make perfect sense. But while forming divisions may create a sense of logical conceptual map, we have to ask, does it create a deep sense of clarity? And does it put to rest the underlying sense of discontentment, misalignment, longing for something? Now, if the answer was yes, then we wouldn't be here. There would not be a place of practice. And our society would not be so diseased and mad. Because it would work. But it doesn't work. Divisions feed the intellect, and the intellect creates logical explanations which serve a functional purpose. But it can only provide short-lived sense of contentment. And so we need to train ourselves out of the restrictions of logic. We need to train ourselves to not create walls and divisions, and to trust that the open vastness is actually more secured than a perceived divided reality. And this is really what we're looking for, a sense of security, a sense of stability, a sense of knowing. But what can we know? What can we truly know? And how deep can that knowing be? Or another way to ask is, why do we insist to know everything? To know or to figure it out? Why do we ask life to make sense? And why are we so disappointed when it doesn't deliver that? Because we are often very disappointed. It should have been, but it's not. I should have been, and I'm not. So what we need to do is train ourselves to not obey the conceptual, chopped-up version of reality that our thoughts seem to inform, and go against the conventional current, which is to go from being upside down to being right side up. We have been trained, very well trained, to value what is false and to disregard or reject what is true. And that training was so systematic to a point of making us feel suspicious about the real and trust what is made up. Zen training is a path of unlearning our false way of being so we can unleash what is real and what is true. We don't trust it. We're actually afraid of it, right? So when you sit in Zazen and you lose touch with who you are, who you think you are, parameters fall away. It's scary. And then you feel like you're floating in midair. No top, no bottom. And often what happens when we're not used to that feeling is we purposefully will look for something to think about because it is too scary. We will produce something to think about, to chew, just so we don't experience that vastness. But is it possible that that vastness is reality and everything else is created in the mind? It's, again, the opposite, right? Thrusting ourselves into that nothingness or no parameterness feels scary, but when we do go deep into that, it actually is extremely supportive and nurturing. And what is producing the fear is what we create. Primarily because it doesn't last, and we want it to last. And also because it doesn't verify. At the end of the day, it doesn't verify reality. It doesn't deliver. So we do need to recognize that the conventional previous training, before we decided to step into Zen training, this previous training is very ingrained in us. And so we have to be disciplined and totally dedicated to this path. Not for the sake of the tradition or the lineage, just because it works. Because if we don't do that, if we don't develop this sense of resolve, we will lose the trust and we will naturally go back to old patterns, which we do. As it often happens with practitioners, so the ongoing advice is train wholeheartedly, but don't be uptight about it. Train wholeheartedly. Fall down, get up, fall down, get up. But don't be uptight. And to train is to learn, as I mentioned yesterday, making mistakes is an essential part of the process. In other words, falling down is inevitable, it's unavoidable, and we should not try to avoid falling down. There's a koan that says this is, you fall down, you get up. It's the same ground that supports you when you fall, and it's the same ground that you push against to get up. Right? You do need to know how to fall, though. We do it in Aikido practice. So to have clear eyes means to see things as they are, and not as we have been indoctrinated to see them. It also means to speak and act from the clarity of seeing things as they are. Master Foyan once said, if someone should question you, how should you speak? Can you speak effectively? If you can only speak after thinking and concentrating, what use is your statement? At midnight, how do you speak? Getting up at dawn, how do you speak? In the hallway, in the washroom, how do you speak? Can you speak effectively? Your eyes must be clear before you can. This is why there is this part of the Zen training is this immediacy. Speak now! You missed it. Let me think about it. Think about what? To figure out what I want to say, how to respond, how to meet the moment. But the moment is telling you how to meet it. We have to pay attention. To speak effectively means to express what needs to be said, clearly and simply, without being vested in anything, without defending anything, without promoting an underlying agenda, and without creating divisions, to speak from a place of clarity or place of equanimity. But before we can express clarity, we need to experience clarity. That's why Foyan says that your eyes must be clear before you can do that. The way you speak reveals where you're at. This is not meant to be criticism or some kind of judgment. It's meant to be a pointer. The introduction says, people are probed with words. Water is probed with a stick. So the stick, as you may know, back in those days, monk used to travel long distances by foot and had to cross rivers along the way. So they would carry a long stick, like the ones outside. And they would check the depth of water before crossing over to the other side to make sure that they can actually walk through. So a stick is used to check the depth of water, and words are used to check the depth of person's understanding. Words are quite messy for us. How can we use them, or how we use them can be detrimental, not just to those who hear us, but to us as well. Right? Because this ear, as I said many times, is the closest ear to this mouth. I hear it first. And then I speak and say, oh, I must have heard it somewhere. Not realizing I'm the one who said it. So then I believe it. The more we speak about something, the more it feels real. And in fact, the more we complain, the more justified we feel to keep complaining. There's a Japanese saying, says the mouth is the source of calamity. It's very good, isn't it? The mouth is the source of calamity. It's very true. A person with clear eyes has no nest. On the other hand, a person that does not see clearly, creates a nest through words and actions. And by protecting the nest, he turns the wheel of samsara. That's what creates samsara. So this koan mentions three prominent Chinese Zen masters from the 9th century, Yantao, Deshan, and Dongshan. Dongshan is the founder of Soto School. Although at the time of this dialogue, Yanta was not yet a teacher. Based on the recorded stories, he spent some time at Dongshan's monastery, but ended up studying with Deshan and later on becoming his successor. So when Yanta came to see Deshan, he straddled the threshold and asked, is this ordinary or is it holy? Straddling the threshold, debating whether to enter or to leave. Will it be worth my time? Why are you here? I asked. Is it worth it? Wonder what will you conclude tomorrow when we end the sesshin? Was it worth it? Was it not? Or maybe not conclude is better, right? Because if I'm here not for any other reason, then I don't need to conclude. It's concluded already. So he's debating whether to stay or leave. Will it be worth his time? Is there a better place for him to practice? Should I go to another monastery? Right? These are common questions often cross our minds and create a lot of inner turmoil. And maybe even now, here, today, a thought about being somewhere else pops into your head. And when it does, we begin fantasizing about another place, about a hot bath, whatever else we want to do, we prefer to do. And what happens when we do this, right? We do it. Well, we don't do it. It just happens. But what happens when we encounter that? Or maybe more precisely, what happens when we follow that thought? Because we do encounter it, not by choice. But when thoughts like this show up, and say, oh yeah, that would have been nice to be there now, to do this now. Then what happens? There is a divide. There is a conflict. And then we look back, well, I should have not signed up for this. Now, vacillating is a common phenomenon for us. And many people spend most of their lives at the threshold. And then feel more familiar with the static state of weighing out the options than actually being decisive, making a decision, and fully committing to whatever, but fully committing. So fully committing to this without defining it, because once we define it, then there are other things. And then there is this or that. And the problem with this or that is not so much with this or that as much as the divide between them. Because we were stuck. And then we're neither here nor there. Right? Because we're not fully committed to this, because something else feels better or sounds better. Then where are we? Or what are we doing? So in terms of practice, right, the Zen tradition, is it holy or is it mundane? Some people choose to enter the path of Buddhism because they perceive it to be a religious practice and it fits what they want. I want a religious practice. Others may have a strong aversion to religion and will stay away from Buddhism unless they are given reassurances that it is an atheist practice or a philosophy. See, I think some practitioners tell their family, oh, it's just a philosophy I'm practicing. Just to not deal with conflicts within the family, right? And the labels in our mind create a sense of a threshold, but in reality, what we call Buddhist practice is an all-inclusive practice of totality, which means it has no threshold. It has no opposite. There is no, I'm practicing Zen, and therefore I'm not practicing this, whatever this may be. If we truly practice Zen, the Zen falls away. In fact, if we truly practice it, we are not interested in the label. Call it whatever you want. I'm just devoting myself fully to this. Not to Zen, to this. Once a non-practitioner held a sparrow in his hand and asked the Buddha, is the sparrow I'm holding dead or alive? The Buddha stood by the threshold, one leg in, one leg out, and answered with a question. Am I about to leave or to enter? Isn't that familiar? Right? Am I about to leave or to enter? But when there is in and out, then there is a debate. Right? As soon as we create an in and an out, we create a debate. And then we weigh out the options. What sounds better? What feels better? What will give me more? Because as soon as such complications arise, then we raise when there is no wind, essentially. And then we have to deal with waves. The waves are real for us. But the fact that there's no wind is also real. Now people say sometimes, I'm not making this up. It's really what's going on. And it's true. For that particular person, it's true. So the experience is real. But we have to investigate. Investigate using the question or asking, am I fully committed? Am I fully committed? Not even to. Maybe even that's too much, right? Fully committed to. That's a problem. Because I'm creating something to be committed to. But if I'm committed to this, and this changes as it does on a momentary basis, right? Then I'm ready to commit to however this changes, or to whatever it changes to, which we're going to have to do after this teisho, as you know, right? I'm sure your mind will have a lot of stuff to say about it. I actually think it's the best part of Sesshin, but... But I didn't ask for it, though, so... Anyway, when we don't see clearly, we create a nest. And the nest can be created inside, outside, or on the threshold itself. But as practitioners, we watch the workings of the mind, and we see that the nest is made up of conceptual twigs and imaginary threads. We see. Doesn't mean we immediately flip it or switch it off and now, okay, I got it, I'm done. No. But at least we see, we look into it and we understand, yeah, well, I am feeling this way, I'm reacting to this, but it is conceptual stuff. It is creation of my mind. So you have to ask, is this ordinary or is it holy? And Deshan immediately shouted. Immediately shouted. Cut through. Right? To cut the two to one. A shout can do that. For a moment. Then we divide again. The next moment. But this is our practice, right? To cut with this, in this moment, in this very moment, whatever the moment is or shows up as, we cut the before, we cut the after, and then the before and after are present in this moment. So Yanta asked, is this ordinary? Deshan shouted, and Yanta immediately bowed. Now, what is it? What is the bow in relation to the shout? Deshan was known as a fierce teacher. And it says that he ordinarily beat the wind and hit the rain. It's a good description, right? So that's what he had to deal with, this kind of fierce energy. There's a story about these two. One day Yanta spread his zabuton to sit, right? And Deshan pushed it down the stairs with his staff. Imagine that, right? You go sit next to your teacher and he just pushes it down. So Yanta went down, gathered the zabuton, and went off. The next day he went up and stood by Deshan. Deshan said, where did you learn this empty-headedness? Where did you learn this empty-headedness? And Yanta said, I never fool myself. And Deshan said, later on you will shit on my head. That's praising him. There are many ways to say that, but yeah. That is a praise. Later on, you will shit on my head. But where did you learn this empty-headedness? And what they're expressing here is incredible spiritual strength. And they do not fool themselves. Because they don't fool themselves, they transmute ordinary into extraordinary, turning iron into gold. So how do we fool ourselves? Erecting conceptual walls, creating doorways, thresholds, nesting, creating a self, defending it, and considering our little bit of knowledge as absolute truth. Oh, I know, right? I got it. So I said today, we did some exercises, right, in the Zendo, some Aikido movement, and I referred to a very basic movement that we do again and again, and it's a lifelong exercise that we never, ever go to a point of I'm done with this or exhaust. There's always so much to learn from that. Simple movement. And then what always happens, you see people do that and you see how quickly we get bored with that. Yeah, I got it. I want to do something else. Something more action. Right? So patience. Right? I talked a few times about patience in this session. Slow down. Slow down. Pay attention. So I've been doing this movement for like almost 35 years now. This basic movement. I can't tell you I got it. I got better at it. I definitely cannot say that I can no longer learn from this. So then you have people trained for a couple of months. Say, I got this one. And you say, okay. Right? Because what can you say? And it's very easy for us to get caught up in our own personal opinions and views and then paint reality with our familiar color schemes and believe it to be real. Because the painting is so automatic, right? We paint it green and say it's green. And then somebody else paints it white and is like, well, can't you see it's green? What are you talking about? Right? Thich Nhat Hanh said that people kill each other or argue with each other over different perspectives of the same reality. It's true. So in this encounter, Yantar was not a novice in the practice, yet he was standing on the threshold, straddling the threshold, raising a divisive question, raising two. Was he probing his teacher? Why would he do it? Was he trying to initiate Dharma encounter to prove his understanding? Maybe he brought it up so we can become more aware of our own habitual way of being. Because here we are, hundreds of years later, looking at this, studying, learning from this encounter. No, our tendency to create a nest doesn't disappear when we enter spiritual practice. And even after years of practice, one can get busy constructing or creating a fixed position and then build divisions. So Deshan gave a piercing shout from a place of no walls and no thresholds. And the footnote says, bursts his brain. You would hope, right? So Yanta was trying to meet Deshan on the same plane, and so he bowed deeply. But the footnote says, this is still not being good-hearted. There's still some remnants of taking a side, still some trace of agenda, a tendency to nest. Sorry, I forget. Later on, Dongshan heard of this encounter and said, anyone but Yanta would hardly get it. And when Yanta heard about Dongshan's comment, he said, all Dongshan does not know good and bad. At that time, I was holding on with one hand and putting down with one hand. Often these great masters would use words for the sake of keeping the Dharma wheel turning, and more than for the sake of praise or criticism. But for us readers with limited understanding, these words can be misleading. The question is, how do you bow in a way that expresses totality? How do you speak and act in a way that cuts all dualities to one? How do you embody unity through your being? Nanto said, all Dongshan does not know good and bad, but not knowing good or bad, is he lost? What does it mean, not knowing good or bad? Are we lost straddling the threshold between right and wrong? Are we not drowning in the sea of yes and no as we vacillate through the journey of life? Dongshan was living in accord with the inviolable law, which governs without judgments or divisions, before good and bad arise in the mind. I spoke about this yesterday in terms of state of mind of an infant who does not know good and bad. And it induces what we perceive as good and bad, but it does not fall into any category. Verse, demolishing the oncomer, holding the handle of authority, tasks have a manner in which they must be carried out. The nation has an inviolable law. So Yanto came with question and was dealt with in a swift action by the authority of Deshan. But tasks have a manner in which they must be carried out. And so we have to bring up questions and raise waves when there is no wind. We do it. We do have questions and we do need to raise them. Yet the nation has an inviolable law. One of the translations of Dharma is law, which is the self-organizing principle of the universe. And everything is subjected to this universal law. Whether we agree with it or not, doesn't change anything. And everything arises and subsides within that. Even the notion of walls and thresholds. In other words, it allows for us to create complications. And it allows for us to realize the created complications. It allows for everything. It does not judge. So Yantao is expressing the investigation of reality. And Deshan, with one piercing shout, is expressing reality before the investigation. Both are necessary expressions of varying degrees of depth. When the guest serves reverently, the host becomes haughty. When the ruler dislikes admonition, the ministers flatter. the underlying meaning yantaras deshan, one upholding, one putting down. See the action of mind. These lines refer to the interaction between these masters and the way they respond to each other to keep the Dharma wheel turning. Sometimes they would teach from a position of the absolute, sometimes a position of the relative. But it's always the action of the one mind that has no nest and no divisions. This one mind also includes the mind that builds walls, takes sides, discriminates, and judges what feels like an opposition. When used well, our discriminated consciousness is a wonderful ability that can help us navigate through life and enjoy the richness and abundance of reality. As long as we are ruled by a capacity to differentiate, we will keep building walls and keep getting trapped in one of the rooms or the thresholds, never realizing that it is all just one big giant house that includes everybody. So to cut through, right? And to cut through has everything to do, so the not nesting or no nesting has everything to do with being dynamic constantly. Constantly, like water. Right, in the Mountains and Waters Sutra, Dogen said, as for water, it is neither strong nor weak, nor it is wet or dry, nor does it move or stay still, nor it is cold or hot, nor does it exist or not exist, nor is it deluded or awakened. It is always in a state of readiness to take on whatever shape is needed. Always at a state of readiness. Which is what I kind of touched on today when we practiced. Movement of unifying, right? So you take two, you make them one, again and again and again, right? Until you realize that even when they seem to be two, they're actually not two, right? But this could be realized when we move from the center. When you bring in, when there is an attack and you suck it into your center, there's one. And that center is moving as one with the other person. And in that interaction, the two lose themselves to the motion, to the movement. So you cannot find anything apart of movement. So there's the four stages of Aikido development. It's also spiritual development. The third and the fourth I want to bring up here quickly. The third one is called the nature of water. Ryu. Realization. This is a significant stage in which technical perfection begins to interact with spiritual realization. The nature of water reveals the action of non-attachment, which is the essence of Buddha, Marshall Way. The highest form of Buddha is beyond relativity, and on an individual level, it is a dynamic expression of unity. That's not limited to Buddha, right? We can practice that on a daily basis in whatever we do. But essentially, it means to study the essence of water and to become like that, or to realize that we are like that. And then the fourth one, forgetting that too, right? So the merging is forgotten. The nature of air, or formlessness, liberation, the aim of Buddha at the highest stage. At this stage, one attains total liberation and absolute freedom, the state of no Buddha. It is said that in the highest stage of Buddha, there's no deliberate action, only perfection of action through non-action, wu-wei. non-doing, doing. And non-doing, doing frees us. It frees all the extra energy that we waste. And it frees us to move and to not look for stability. And what we're terrified of is that. We're terrified of reality. Right? Because reality is unstable, constantly changing. So how can we be terrified of the reality we are born into? How does this happen? The last line of this verse says, one upholding, one putting down. See the action of mind. One song commented on this, saying, in the present time, all novices who just shed their civilian clothes look at this line and say, how strange it is that Zen folk did not consent to explain things through for people. After all of this is the action of mind. So they become students clever of deceit. I say, one bit of mental action is a bit of compassion. If you don't encounter something, you don't know how to cope with it, right? If you don't encounter, you don't know how to cope with it. You might say that fruit comes from within a flower. Sweet comes from bitter. That's our training. It's a strange and long journey. We strive to arrive at unity. But nothing has ever been fragmented. Even so, we still have to go through the challenges. We still create suffering and drive ourselves and each other nuts before we realize that things have never been otherwise. And the Buddha said that this is a long, long journey. But as long as we understand that to practice means to train, then time is not an issue. And destination is definitely not a concern. Right? Because if we're doing this not for any other reason, then it works. Right? We do it not for any other reason, and it does what it needs to do. It does a much better job. Right? The training will be much more open for us if we enter the training without expectation of it doing something for me at a particular time frame. Then we forget training. Right? Then the training just happens. So training happens. So now, after this teisho, we're going to port our things, right? That's the plan. Right? Then we're going to move to another building. So that will change. But at the same time, it's the same center, right? The center doesn't mind. You could be here, you could be there. It's the same. So during that porting, whatever we need to do, don't do it from the head. Do it from your center. The head will have a lot to say about that. But never mind that. Bring the attention down to the center and you'll see how much easier it becomes. How much welcoming you can be. Welcome whatever happens. Thank you for coming. I'm up for that.